So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
How dare you crack whip with the American dream? How dare you crack whip with Arn Anderson? How dare you crack whip with any of these legends? Let me tell you something. The table you're eating off of, the table that you're eating off of right now, was built by these legends right here. What the... Without that table, you wouldn't have any food. Now I'm going to go back to what I was talking about. Mr. Harley Race, the champ.
Harley Race? You talking about the 5-time, 9-time, 10-time world champion? You talking about him setting the table? Because it looks like you haven't passed up any buffet tables.
No! Oh, Harley Race!
Look at that! Look at that!
Patterson!
Oh, Hacksaw! Conway! Look at this! Look at this!
A green's gonna flip flop and fly!
Here it comes! Oh, oh, no.
The Bionic Elbow!
Wait! Oh, no!
The claw! The barbaric claw! The barbaric claw!
Look at this!
Rob, you gotta get out of there! Rob, you got to get out of there!
The crowd is going nuts!
Rob, Conway's not going anywhere with that claw clip on!
Conway put down on the Bionic claw!
I'm coming home! I'm coming home! Tell the world that I'm coming home. Let the rain wash away all the pain of yesterday. I know my kingdom awaits, and they've forgiven my mistakes. I'm coming home, I'm coming home. Tell the world I'm
welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock alongside Waiting. Way.
What's up?
How are you?
Fucking great. It's just a great day.
I'm doing wonderful myself.
Yeah.
Very excited just about today's show.
It's beautiful weather.
It's wonderful. It's like raining. It's teeming outside, as
it's
they call
just
it.
Such a nice, calm breeze, you know. It's that time of year where you just feel like...
I'm going to get sick.
No. I was going to say happy to be alive.
Oh. Is there ever a time you're not happy to be alive?
Maybe like...
Is there a time of the year where you're like, this life shit's overrated?
No, not really. Not really. I'm pretty grateful for this opportunity to be alive at all times.
I'm going to take a sharp turn right and just see where this goes. But do you ever think of the afterlife? Is that ever something that you think about? You're someone that strikes me as someone that does, get lost in your thoughts and just thinks about
the afterlife.
About where we're all going after this. This was my biggest fear as a child, was this idea.
Dying?
Not dying, but being in this, it's just darkness for eternity afterwards. And you're just, it's an eternal nothing afterwards.
And why is that a fear? Who cares? You wouldn't be even be conscious to realize that there's darkness.
Isn't that really depressing to think that once you're dead, it's just nothing forever?
But it's not. It's nothing, but you won't even be there to suffer from it. You know what I mean? Like, you're not even a thing anymore, so who cares?
Yeah, but it's like, what will my consciousness, like, where...
It won't even exist. If you truly believe that there's going to be nothing.
Well, that sucks.
Consciousness won't,
that sucks.
Why would it suck?
Because it's nothing. I mean, I want to have some kind of presence. I'm not saying there's a...
You're doing that. You're
necessarily a...
Why do you think we're recording these podcasts? We're trying to create, upload our consciousness in the form of wrestling reviews.
My best theory that I've come up with is that you die, and then you get selective do-overs. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure, where you get to go back, and not that you necessarily know that you are reliving certain things, but that you have an opportunity to correct certain mistakes. And that's why we have successful people in this world who you just look at as genius. It's like, yeah, because they've been here before, and now they know how to redo it.
What do you base this theory on?
Pure bullshit.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're speaking of reincarnation, or at least a form of reincarnation.
To a degree, yes, but kind of not in a different life you're living. It's almost like
not a different species.
I think you could come back, possibly. All possible.
Like, oh, that rat's a really successful rat. So he must have, you know.
He's going to move up in the food chain and come back as maybe a more reinvigorated dog. Rat, like the king of the rats or something.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, I knew this was going to be a deep turn.
Yeah. We're getting all the, like, we've had complaints about sports fans telling us not to talk about sports because we know nothing about sports. We're going to get all the
reincarnation chat.
Yeah, reincarnation experts telling us not to talk about this stuff.
I don't care.
I don't care.
Not my problem.
We're two idiots talking about. We don't know anything about wrestling either, and you guys listen to us talk about that, so.
It's fine.
At least I know nothing about wrestling. You know a lot.
No, not really. I just read a book once. That's it.
Yeah, so do I ever think about the afterlife?
What would be your ideal scenario? How about that? What would you like to believe exists after?
Okay. Well, I would love to believe in the concept of like a heaven. Well, that would be very nice.
What is heaven to you?
It's very soothing to think that my ancestors and the people that we all loved are looking over us from the heavens.
That's not weird.
It's a very soothing thought.
Yes.
And I don't know. Nobody I've ever talked to has died before. I haven't had that experience of talking to somebody who's had the experience of death, or at least like real prolonged death. So I can't really say I know what to expect.
That'd be really freaky if someone just, you're drunk one night and your buddy's just like, yo, way, I've been here before. I've been here, Wei Chun.
Sounds like Gordon saying this.
Oh, I was just going with a stereotypical friend of yours. I wasn't trying to go down a direction. I would believe it if he had been reincarnated.
I don't even know.
He's an extra piece of work. You know what I mean?
I don't know what his thoughts are about the afterlife, but
he would definitely share them after a few beers, I think.
Perhaps. I don't know. For me, I feel like, you know, you should really just kind of focus on what you're on your life right now, and you can't worry too much about the future.
That's true. I can't say I give too much thought about it, but you've got to have some theory about what happened.
I don't really have much of a theory.
I guess not. Maybe not. Well, that's
what do you think? Would you like to be cremated or buried?
Probably cremated.
Yeah, why is that?
I just don't like the idea of being buried. It just seems I realize it's not going to make any difference.
Burnt? Huh? Rather be burnt into a crisp ash?
It's more so the I just think it's such a bizarre tradition.
Burial?
We're going to put you in a box and bury you. I guess there's no sanitary way to move on, I guess.
No, it's more about claiming a spot, basically.
Yeah, I don't want to take a broom.
It's gonna be expensive. I mean, especially
to be buried.
Yeah, especially in Toronto. I mean, Jesus, to even own a condo is quite pricey.
Oh yeah, I mean,
imagine owning a plot of land somewhere close to the city. It's not gonna be cheap.
It's a heavy expense. I don't think I'd want to go that.
So, if you want to be cremated, where would you want your ashes to be spread? By the way, this is still a review of WWE Raw.
They're all gone.
2005.
They're all gone. They've all moved into the afterlife.
But where would you like your ashes to be spread, John? As we talk about professional wrestling.
You know, I don't have really a tie to any particular place. Maybe,
would you want to be kept in an urn?
No, spread them out. I think that's really weird.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but imagine that it would get knocked over and fall over the floor and break, and it's just, ugh, how weird.
Maybe I wouldn't want an urn. I would want something like, maybe
like a Tim Hortons cup.
I don't know about that. Something metal I'd want, at least. Maybe like a cool, how about like a vase?
Like a vase could be nice.
Yeah.
You put some flowers in with you.
You know what? How about like a Lego Death Star? You put my ashes in that. That would look cool. And, you know, the Death Star. How perfect.
It would be very fitting, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not one to, you'd want them like put out on the water or something like that, or?
I wouldn't mind. I don't know about that. The only thing I have against that is, the person who has to, like, I'm watching the George Takei documentary.
Yes.
And, it's great. He's excellent.
I heard the documentary is really good.
Yeah. Anyway, so he and his partner Brad, his husband, they're spreading the ashes of Brad's parents, and like they're spreading it on top of a mountain.
Oh,
and
no.
They're pouring these ashes out, and they go everywhere.
Oh.
Like, they go all over their pants.
Oh, like, man.
And then, like, in the car, George and his husband are joking. I think I've got some of your mother on my hands. I think there's going to be some of your mother in the laundromat later, too.
You gotta be really comfortable with someone to be joking around like that.
But so that's the only thing I would have against like spreading of ashes is because you're gonna be everywhere. You're gonna be in your kid's fingertips. You're gonna be probably breathing in some of your some of the ash. Let's be honest here.
Yeah, I just feel it's a much. I mean, going to enough funerals where it's like. All of a sudden, it's like you get to the cemetery and they've got like the hole already dug up. It's just what a primitive practice that we still go forward with.
Well, it's tradition.
Yeah, and that's
why it's.
I don't feel
primitive.
That's always the best argument of why we continue something. That's tradition. I mean, it is practical. There is a practicality to what you do with a body. I will say. For pure practicality, cremation does make a lot more sense.
Yeah, sure.
There are
in terms of
billions
space.
And billions and billions of people, and the sad truth is every single one of them is going to die at some point. That's a fact.
Sure. But we're talking, it's not even about practicality, though, when you're talking about, basically, when somebody dies, I think a lot of us want to be preserved. For as long as possible, even if that means, a lifeless body in a spot. I think we just want our last impression to be of us intact, looking pristine and perfect as we're lowered into the ground.
Would you want an open casket at your funeral? I would hate that.
I don't even know if that would be up to
Have you ever been to one?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Both of my grandparents. Open caskets. Actually, I think every funeral I've been to has been open casket.
See, that to me is I would not want that.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be down with that.
I
either.
Think that's just
to put a nice photo of me up there.
Yes, there you go.
How about a hologram of me?
Wow.
That should be the future, really. I mean, if they can make one for Tupac at my funeral,
you give your eulogy?
Yeah. Perfect.
Yes.
I'll even go up and
do it. You'd be the MC at your funeral.
I should go up and rap, actually. I should do California Love at my eulogy.
I bet you we are not that far away from some kind of technology where, I mean, even something as simple as someone recording a message when they know they're going to be passing away. I'm surprised.
That's happened.
I know it's happened. I'm surprised it's not more of a thing at funerals where someone's last words are spoken to everybody.
Hmm.
I mean, what a tearjerker, but
yeah.
It seems something that we are moving towards idea of your hologram being the ultimate destination.
Now, if you do that, would you, like, edit it? Would you, like, put some nice music underneath it?
Well, I definitely have you edit it for me afterwards.
Sure.
I'd want some nice B-roll. I'd want a multiple camera shoot,
hot
of course.
Dog.
I'd want it over the shoulder as I look down.
As you talk about hot dogs, I'll put some B-roll of hot dogs.
Exactly, of course. And some ribs.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I wonder how that would be a very awkward speech, though, to say.
Not sure you can work hot dogs or ribs in there.
I'd want to end with, like, either a really good joke or like an ominous mystery.
Okay, it could be both.
Yeah. I would want to plan out like this. I would want to plan out the seating chart.
Yeah.
So that in my video, I could point to people, and say, "Hey, Wei, turn around, and say hi to Frank."
Yeah.
And they would. How did he know that's where he was sitting? Like that would I would want to
freak people out. Yeah. Why stop there? Why not have a lookalike show up? A number of lookalikes show up.
You jump out of the screen and that's when the hologram appears.
We're actually talking about an Undertaker angle now at some point.
This could be.
We should really just replicate that.
Really, the Royal Rumble 94, the casket match and his explosion.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been built upon. I think the world could have learned a lot from Providence, Rhode Island that night.
Yes.
Raw Homecoming. You know, the many said in 2000 that the relationship between the WWF and the then USA Network was dead and buried and would never be resurrected. Oh, but boy. Here we are 5 years later.
Nice.
And Viacom, through Spike TV, announced, we're done. We're done with these guys. They're done. And the WWF was kind of caught off guard by all this. Their contract was coming due. They were getting paid at the time $28 million a year by Viacom. That was part of the attractiveness of jumping away from USA. And here they are left without any leverage with any other networks. And this was important because it was during this time period when they kind of got blindsided that Spike was going to publicly say we're not negotiating with them any longer, that the beginning planning stages of the WWE Network of having something like that, an outlet, began some 10 years ago. And then they ended up going back to USA. They got a good deal with them, but they certainly took a big hit because going back to USA, unlike their prior relationship with Spike, they were not going to be sharing in the advertising revenue. That would all be done through USA. So they took a massive hit coming back to USA, but they were going to a very prestigious cable network, and this was the big return on October the 3rd of 2005 in Dallas, Texas, where they presented a card that got very interesting in the week or so leading up, because the Spike TV ended up putting a UFC card head-to-head with this Raw Homecoming show and was an interesting head-to-head battle at the time.
Is that the current deal that they're still on, that current arrangement where they don't get the ad revenue?
They've since signed new contracts in that time period, but it's still they don't share in that advertising revenue.
Interesting. And what do you know? What ultimately led to Viacom's parting ways? Because obviously it wasn't necessarily a lack of not wanting to have wrestling on, because they would soon get TNA afterwards.
I think it was mainly being in business with the WWE that I think that there was issues on both sides, and the WWF wanted a lot more money, and their numbers had gone down since 2000. This was 2005. They were no longer in this peak period at all, and they wanted more money, and Spike was not interested. And they also had this property now in the UFC that it hadn't fully exploded, but certainly this was after the first season of The Ultimate Fighter had wrapped up in April,
which was piggybacked off of Raw.
Exactly. That was where Raw became extremely valuable for them to finally have a show that can piggyback off the audience of WWF, because typically Raw would do great numbers, but then they wouldn't be spread out and you didn't become viewers of Spike. Mancers or whatever the fuck, Stripperella, some of those shows.
Mancers, there's wasn't the Joe...
MXC was on.
MXC.
I'm trying to think of the Spike lineup 10 years ago.
The Joe Schmo Show was one of my favorites. I thought it was a great show. What else?
That is all that comes
Mancers,
to mind.
Mancers was a big one.
Mancers was a big one over the past decade. So with the UFC, and then TNA kind of just came out of nowhere, because most thought, well, Spike, why would they get rid of the number one wrestling company for a secondary promotion that's going to do a fraction of the numbers? But to TNA's credit, they have been able to... I think TNA has a great ability that when they sit down, they are able to forge relationships with certain networks. And the Spike one was a huge get for them at the time. Mm-hmm. There's a huge question if TNA would have continued if they didn't get that Spike deal. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that not only did this show take place just a few weeks after the Unbreakable show we did last week, but this weekend prior to this featured not only TNA's debut on Spike on the Saturday night, but that Saturday night was also Joe versus Kobashi.
Wow.
What a big weekend.
That's huge.
And then on...
Five-star match.
A five-star match.
Yeah, isn't that like 2 5-star matches in a row for Samoa Joe? The three-way and then Joe versus Kobashi.
Yeah, they were 3 weeks apart.
Wow.
I wonder if that's the closest proximity any performer has had to 5-star matches. I guess great Sasuke on that Super J Cup all in one night.
Oh, okay. Were there 2 5-star
matches? Well, he had three matches. I think... I can't remember the exact...
We'll check the list.
Ratings. But nonetheless, that took us into this Monday night and... A 3-hour Raw. What a concept. They were going to do a 3-hour Raw to mark this extravaganza.
It's a 3-hour Raw, and I guarantee you they looked at that as a daunting challenge. How are we going to make 3 hours interesting enough to keep our viewers watching. 3 hours? Let's cram this show. That's what it felt like.
And one of the interesting stories going into this particular night was something that ultimately did not happen, but Vince McMahon went back to his, I guess, territorial war days where he can't raid any fighters from the UFC, but he did attempt to raid their lead play-by-play announcer, Mike Goldberg.
That's right.
And a little later on, we are going to hear from Mike Goldberg, who was on the Law just a few weeks after this, to talk about what exactly happened. But he was given a big money offer by the WWE to no-show the UFC event on this Monday night, appear on Raw, and he was going to replace Jim Ross as the full-time announcer on Raw. Can you imagine how that would have gone in hindsight? This was one of their latest let's get rid of Jim Ross kicks that they were on.
It's just to even hear that repeated, it's one of those mind-boggling steps in logic that I don't know how it was even thought of. It's like, it's as if Vince thought the reason why the UFC is successful is because of their announcers and not because of, not even the good one.
Well, to be fair, I mean, Jim Ross really did drag them down during that Attitude Era.
Yes,
I mean,
course.
Where could they have been if they had just had a northern voice for that show? I mean,
I think
they were struggling.
It's interesting.
It was
a big shot at the UFC.
It was. As much of a fuck you as it was to Jim Ross, the bigger target was, it was UFC. They were just trying to screw with them, but they weren't going to be able to lure Joe Rogan over.
Yeah, I guess not. But honestly, would it have made a big of a difference? I think
it
would have just hurt the WWE. It would have just hurt the show.
And it would have hurt Mike Goldberg, because how long would he have lasted in that role?
He would have been Mike Adamley.
And he would have probably not been taken back by the UFC, I would think. I mean, he must look back and be, you know, it's a great lesson out there that the money offer was incredible that the WWE was offering. And the UFC, they were not running shows every weekend like they are now. It was a much more limited schedule in 2005. But at the end of the day, they were able to convince Mike Goldberg to stay. He got a sizable raise at the UFC. And I'm sure he's looking back at what a bullet he dodged.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny is that even as life was telling you, all right, let's stick with Jim Ross, they still went ahead and got rid of him with the angle where Linda McMahon kicked him in the balls.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ended up with Joey Styles returning as a play-by-play announcer. And this was that whole time period where we had the Dr. Heine skit. I mean, they really had it out for Jim Ross during this return to the USA Network. And he became just their punching bag.
Yeah.
It was horrible television at the time.
But we could have had the debut of Cold Stone Steve Austin on this show.
Of Cold Stone Steve Austin.
Mike Goldberg made that flub on a UFC show once.
Oh, I don't even remember this.
Yeah.
But yeah, he would have, maybe him and Mike Tyson. Remember Mike Tyson did the same thing?
Cold Stone?
He called him Cold Stone.
I don't remember that.
Well, there you go. Together we have a memory. So the show started off with, there was this 5-minute countdown with Vince McMahon describing what Raw was.
Yeah,
so this was actually a 3-hour and 5-minute edition of Raw.
Probably more with the
overrun at the end. This was a long show.
Mm-hmm.
Vince describing that Raw is something you can feel it, you can touch it, and you can smell it.
Yes. By the way, before we continue, was this on the network? Did you find this on the network or?
No? Oh no! I watched this on.
This
Daily
was on.
Motion.
This was uploaded on Daily Motion for those of you who actually wanted to see it. But this was also released as a DVD in
the UK.
That's
right. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why they didn't release it here, but in the UK it was actually packaged as a Raw Homecoming 2005 DVD.
Man, imagine that, buying 3-hour Raws on DVD. I wonder if they could do that today.
So if it was a really good one. Not any random one.
The night after WrestleMania, 3-hour Raw. I don't think
that's a bad idea.
Well, I guess they're all on the network. It really doesn't matter.
There are collectors out there who'll pay for everything. And some of those particular Raws are definitely worth watching.
Yeah, this was a huge show. You could almost argue too big, because there was so much to this show.
Uh-huh.
Every name under the sun they tried to get on this show, including Bret Hart, who would not come on this show. He was the one holdout, I guess, along with Mike Goldberg. you know, Bret Hart, Mike Goldberg, the necessary ingredients to make this Raw homecoming show. But what was so funny was that just a few weeks before, SmackDown had been moved from Thursday nights to Friday nights on UPN or whatever it was at this time, the CW network. Anyway, it was being moved, and the difference of promotion for Raw to SmackDown being moved to a new night. Obviously, it was the difference between Raw and SmackDown.
This really came across like them wanting to impress USA, you know, with a high ratings grab.
It was absolutely to appease USA that they made the right investment, but it was also funny that you are also entering a new contract where you're paid the exact same based on what your ratings do. But obviously, you want a big audience, but they threw everything out here. So we had this little five-minute countdown.
A lot of focus during this little countdown on the Attitude Era.
And I would say that trickled in throughout the whole show, this idea that we are going back to a more risque product. And it ended up feeling like this felt like such a dated presentation of pro wrestling in 2005. But they had Braun Panties matches on here. We had Mae Young throughout this. Mm-hmm. They were definitely trying to push that. The Austin McMahon stuff. It was like we were basically trying to turn back time to when we were on USA the last time.
Yeah, I think we still get that a little bit today. But, you know, on this show, it was incredibly blatant. Hey, guys, remember that stuff you loved back in the late 90s? We're back. This is going to be it. This is going to be just like that. Trust us.
Yeah, and they showed clips here from the Attitude Era, including the Yamaguchi-san angle with Val Venus, Mark Henry with a transvestite, complete with the shot of Mark Henry's shocked mother in attendance watching her son being blown. And then we had the three pillars of the history of Monday Night Raw speak. We had Vince McMahon, Bobby Heenan, the first commentator on Raw, and of course, the natural third man in that group, Sean Mooney.
Oh, right.
What a random
Sean Mooney was interviewed.
Find Sean Mooney back from the past. And then Raw kicked off with our announced team of Jim Ross, Jerry Lawler, and Jonathan Coachman at this particular time in Raw history. And to start the show, Mick Foley came out, and this was interesting as well, because prior to this return, Mick Foley had gone to Vince McMahon and said he was accepting an offer with TNA, and the WWE ended up giving Mick Foley a big offer to stay, but Foley has always said that after he decided to go to TNA, he believes Vince McMahon never looked at him quite the same after that, like he had turned his back on this company. So he was back, but he felt that he was somewhat, he was no longer in that inner circle that he once was. But he was the big plan when they went to Spike TV was to get the Dudley Boys, Mick Foley, and they were also hoping to get Matt Hardy by that time as well. But the WWE, they grabbed Matt Hardy, brought him back that summer, and they signed Mick Foley.
Interesting. Interesting.
So Mankind comes out, and we've got the Piper's Pit set up in the ring, and he welcomes us as tonight's host. And what a host he was on this particular show. Laid out in the opening segment and never heard from again. Roddy Piper comes out, and Piper puts over Foley for all his stunts he has performed, calling him nuts. And I'm guessing that Piper and Foley talked behind the scenes earlier in the day. Said, listen, Hot Rod, I've got a book out. If you can mention it, I'll mention your movie. So they just casually worked in plugs for each other's projects here, which I'm sure the WWE was probably unaware that they were going to give a platform to plug Honor, starring Roddy Piper.
They probably also discussed their wardrobe and how you wear the flannel shirt, Mick, and I'll wear the flannel kilt.
Oh, that's right.
They were
a tag team.
We will be on a flannel mat for this Piper's Pit. There's a lot of red flannel in this segment.
So Piper asks when Foley is coming back to the WWE. And I didn't want to be a jerk here, but I was like, we're watching this return.
He means in ring.
I guess in the ring. He says he would need a really good reason after his loss to Randy Orton last year. And Piper then starts up a Foley chant, and they get interrupted by Randy Orton with his father, Cowboy Bob. And Foley runs him down and says the Undertaker is going to do the same to Randy at No Mercy that Sunday. So keep in mind, there was a pay-per-view this Sunday. SmackDown pay-per-view, which I think was mentioned two times on this particular three-plus-hour show. poor SmackDown in 2005. Orton says he's here to talk to Piper and tells him to shut his mouth. Says that Piper would be nothing without his father, who always took all the abuse, but Piper got all the glory. He shoves Piper, and then Piper drops Randy. They start fighting. They actually did, like, the cat fight rolling spot on the mat. And then Bob decks Foley. Randy hits an RKO to Piper, and then an RKO to Foley. And just to fully complete his mission, Randy stands up and takes his shirt off. And that ended the segment. And I'll say, of all the SmackDown involvement on this show, Randy Orton was the only guy to me that came off like a star over on SmackDown.
There's no contest. He's the only guy with a speaking role, and the lights were turned off on his performance.
The other fools that were just made a fool of later on in the show, you're right, were not even a close second. But Orton, I guess a good segment for Randy, but to my recollection, this didn't really go anywhere with Piper, even though there was kind of that tease.
Piper, even by this point, didn't look to be in any shape to wrestle a match.
No,
I don't know if he would have gotten much else besides, you know, these RKO stunts. But I thought he came across great. Orton, he came across like a guy with a lot of confidence. And you could tell, you know, this guy was already a main eventer, even at this point.
They showed highlights of Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels from both WrestleMania 21 and then their rematch at Vengeance earlier in the year. They had split wins, and they cut to the graphics package, which were, you know, animated videos of each guy, and it's always the worst thing Shawn Michaels has ever done in his career is this pose where he's got pose for the camera, and he does that punch to his chin.
Oh, that one.
And then gives that shit-eating grin. Every time I see this thing, I just hate it. I hated it so much. It's the worst contribution to wrestling in Shawn Michaels' career. Is this
worse than the hats and the shirts and the...
This is worse.
Okay.
I can't get ready for a big Shawn Michaels match when that's what I see.
It's one of those things where, like, hey, Sean, you got a second to shoot this little thing for the things? And then Sean's like, oh, yeah, sure, okay. And he just comes up with it on the spot.
I feel they did 15 poses, and by the end of it, he was just, like, fucking around, and they went with it.
Sure. Those things are awkward. I mean, you know, you've had to, like, stand in front of a background to take photos. You know how awkward? You remember how
awkward? Look how intense Angle looked. Like, no one else had a big issue with it.
I suppose, but I guess Sean at this point was more carefree character.
I guess so. This is a main event guy, so he's probably involved in important matches.
Right.
And it just drove me nuts.
Right.
It drove me nuts. Like, get me into the moment here, you know? I don't want to see, you know, Daniel Cormier with his title, and he's doing peekaboo right as we're about to get ready for his next title defense against Jon Jones. You know what I mean?
I think, though, just to play devil's advocate, the goal is to not necessarily, you know, be maybe too carefree like Sean, but you don't also want to seem generic. You don't want to, you want to leave a bit of an impression. And obviously, Sean left one with you. I don't know if it was necessarily the best one, but, you know, your goal is to always try to convey personality, I think, in any small task, right?
It'll be part of the very small argument when trying to argue that Shawn Michaels was not the greatest WWE performer of the last 20 years. I mean, it's hard to argue, but that would be in my backpack of things. Guys, that video package, for Christ's sake. I mean, come on. Teddy Long is backstage with Eric Bischoff. They were the GMs on SmackDown and Raw, respectively. Bischoff is storming in, upset over Randy Orton appearing on his show. Should have been upset at that, the fact they had his music and they played his video and they shot him. But Teddy claims he had nothing to do with it. And Bischoff warns him it better not happen again tonight involving his SmackDown pieces of shit. They showed a bunch of legends all in the ringside area. We saw Jimmy Hart, who was just at Unbreakable a few weeks prior.
That is right.
And was part of TNA. Guy just had an incredible relationship with everybody.
Uh-huh.
Because he was not done with TNA at this point and was still able to appear on WWE programming.
How did that work? Was he just a freelancer?
Yeah, he didn't. I think he had a Legends deal, but they allowed him to work at TNA. It's somewhat similar. Like, Tommy Dreamer's now a road agent at TNA, but then he's done, like, NXT live events and just seems, you know, certain guys that they're just okay with. Other ones here, I mean, Harley Race, Dusty Rhodes, Jimmy Snuka, Volkoff, Moolah, Mae Young, Red Bastien was there, Hillbilly Jim, Coco Beware, Dr. Death, Superstar Billy Graham, Jim Duggan, tons of guys all flown in for this. And then we got our 30-minute Iron Man match. I totally forgot about this. How appropriate with NXT TakeOver tonight.
Tonight.
With Sasha Banks and Bayley.
That's right.
I guess maybe they'll be following this blueprint. Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels.
Bayley probably watched this one in her studying of tapes.
I'm sure. Did you enjoy that video package?
I actually didn't see it yet.
No, you didn't see it.
I'll probably catch it during the show.
So this match certainly... some high expectations, for sure. And this was one match, I guess you could argue, I mean, they could have saved it for a pay-per-view, but it was just all guns blazing for this particular episode of Raw.
This was also the third in their trilogy.
Yeah, this was the culmination, I guess, of their series. Michaels just charges in to start the match and has the early advantage until Angle hits him with a suplex. Slower pace to start, as they're obviously going 30 minutes here. Michaels back body drops Angle over the top to the floor and fully rotates over. That's when Angle would do that insane back body drop. Just the full rotation. Just always looked nuts. Angle is selling his shoulder, and then Michaels misses with a baseball slide, takes an Angle slam on the floor, and then Angle uses a buckle bomb back in the ring for a two count, and then they showed the replay where it was more like a rope bomb. Where Michaels conveniently moved and avoided the buckle. So Sting should have been watching this match and preparing. Learn the tricks of the trade from one Shawn Michaels. Michaels then knocks him off the turnbuckle, and Angle runs back up, hits an Angle slam off the top, and he scores the first fall as they went to their first commercial break. Came back, ankle lock is applied, and then gets countered into a roll-up, so Michaels ties it halfway through the match. Angle then applies a body scissors wearing down Michaels. There was a dude in the front row plugging his MySpace page as we got our timestamp on this particular Raw.
He also had a dude in the front row wearing a TNA shirt for another timestamp.
Oh.
I don't think you'd see that much today.
There was another one near the front. Maybe it was all the same guy. His sign read, CM Punk is the future.
Oh. This is just Mr. 2005.
Yeah. I love this. It feels like 20 years ago. Then we have an O'Connor roll by Michaels. Angle turns into the ankle lock. Michaels is trying to kick Angle off, and Angle continues, and then finally gets the tap with 11 minutes remaining, go through another commercial break. Michaels makes a comeback, does the kip up, sells his injured ankle, hits an elbow drop off the top, and then hits a sweet chin music and ties it at two apiece with just under 5 minutes to go. Michaels then runs into the corner, kicks out of an angle slam. Michaels counters an angle slam with a tornado DDT, and then Michaels hits a moonsault off the top. Angle rolls over, applies the ankle lock, and won't release it, and they pretty well played off the finish of WrestleMania, where Michaels is teasing the tap, and Michaels is selling this tremendously well, turns Angle over and kicks him off, sends Angle into the corner. He avoids hitting the referee, turns around into the sweet chin music, but time expires, and it ends at 2-2. What did you think of the actual match?
I thought it was a good match. Not a classic, you know, from either of the men, but for a TV match, I don't think there's anything you can complain about. This is a very, very good TV match. You know, in particular, I love the finish with the finishing sequence with the ankle lock and just the way, you know, these two were able to just with the same very move create a whole story with Angle trying to do variations of the ankle lock to keep Shawn in there. And I think the thing that you should really commend for in any type of Iron Man match is really the cardio. That's the main thing that I think we watch for. And both of these men showed no signs of slowing down even towards the 30-minute mark at the end here.
Yeah, so It was a very good television match. Mm-hmm. I think you can watch it. Certainly, they had set the standard very high. I feel that the WrestleMania match is the one that everyone will remember between these two. But a lot of time on television for this particular match.
Now, I wonder how this did in the ratings, because the danger with these Iron Man matches and the reason why people stay away from these on TV is because they know people will always tune out until the last minutes, right?
Yeah, I don't know how the quarter hours all worked out, other than the overall rating. I did get it here. They did compare this to today, a 4.39 and 5.6 wow. million viewers. Mm-hmm. And if you measured the actual 2 hour, like 9 till 11 or so, which is the usual time slot, it was 6 million they mm-hmm. averaged. So okay.
This was, the timing of this was interesting, because it probably went on about like 8:30. Ish. So
right.
Probably to time it right up till the 9 o'clock.
Yeah, but you bring up a great point. I mean, Iron Man matches typically on television, they're not great because you know when the finish is. You know when to tune out and when you can tune back in. Michaels gets on the microphone after. He wants a sudden death overtime, but Angle turns and leaves, and they play Shawn Michaels' music, and then he hugs with some of the legends, including Coco Beware, who has Frankie with him.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, wow. He had Frankie with him as Michaels is, you know, catching up with the Birdman.
Imagine if Frankie just interrupted the match, flew in there, and just shat on
that's
him.
That'd be a first. They fly in.
Yeah.
Lillian Garcia then introduces Kevin Von Erich, who gets a huge reaction, being that they are in Dallas, and he does the claw sign.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few things that just without fail, they will always click. And Kevin Von Erich, in any wrestling environment in Dallas, mm-hmm. it's just going to work.
I would say he probably got one of the top reactions of the whole night.
Oh, the later, absolutely, when they actually did the claw spot. Mm-hmm. And I always go back to it. Last year's Slammiversary, it was the highlight of the show, was Kevin Von Erich there mm-hmm. applying the claw. It's mm-hmm. That's incredible, mm-hmm. that kind of staying power in that market,
yes.
and what the Von Erichs meant, that
yes.
unless you were there, you can't fully comprehend.
Yeah, it's incredible that, you know, for, I'd say, a family that didn't necessarily fit into the WWE narrative of, you know, the WrestleManias
yep.
or anything, the fact that, you know, in 2015, 2014, they'd still get this type of reaction, I think it says something that about just how much of a lasting impression they created.
It's a great point. Like, the Von Erichs, like, Vince and Fritz always had a very good relationship. And they would send in footage and stuff where the Von Erichs stuff from World Class, it would occasionally air on WWF syndicated television. But you're right, they were not part of the extensive WWF narrative of those people who were just, yeah, they came in at the expansion period.
Did Kerry even do the claw?
Not in the WWF. He did the big discus punch, and that was it. And that was Kerry at, you know, the tail end of his career, and still came in and had an average run, you can say, but certainly not at the level he was in Texas. So then Kevin is introduced, and we go to Vince McMahon in the back. Eric Bischoff walks up, and we've got John Cena against Eric Bischoff as our big main event for the WWE title. And Eric wants a no DQ stipulation for the match. McMahon says no. So then Bischoff, instead of calling him Mr. McMahon, now calls him Vince and says he was only hired to be embarrassed as the general manager of Raw, playing off the sentiment that I think most had of Eric Bischoff's hiring in this company. And he asks if all of this has been done so that one day he can produce the Self-Destruction of Eric Bischoff DVD. And this was just weeks after they had released the Ultimate Warrior DVD, so it was not just a vague reference. And calls Vince sick and perverted. And McMahon agrees and says, no one knows how sick and perverted I can be, as he walks away, and we would be aware of that.
Do you know if you can watch that Self-Destruction DVD on the network? I would think not.
I don't think it's up there. I'm almost positive it's not.
Yeah. It's so interesting.
But now, it does exist, and we almost had Screwed, the Bret Hart story at this
yeah,
time as well, before
right.
Bret made amends. And the Warrior DVD, I think, was a big reason why Bret, he did not want Screwed to be released.
That's right.
Then Lillian Garcia, after the commercial break, reads this ridiculous intro for Vince McMahon, including the characteristic that he is well endowed and the creator of a billion-dollar industry, who created Hulk Hogan, The Rock, and Steve Austin. And Vince McMahon comes out and pushes that they are uncensored on the USA Network and reminiscent of the old days. And he starts talking about the old days.
The old days.
He brings up the date February the 8th of 1998 and says he remembers it clearly. You know why it wasn't that clear, Way?
Because they would show the clip and it would say February 1999 right on the screen.
And you know what Raw that was?
What?
It was at the Sky Dome.
Oh,
in Toronto.
You attended.
So he was off by a year. So Vince McMahon, clear as day. And they play the video where it was Vince just getting into Austin's face after a gauntlet match. And yeah, that was hilarious that they had it keyed as 1999 and pinning Austin at the Sky Dome. And then they show another moment of Austin being arrested. And then it gets cut off by Austin coming out. And Vince says he was just joking around. Austin does the what routine and says he has his own highlight video. And shows Vince getting hit with a bedpan from the segment in 1998. And then pulling out a gun on Vince, which was the fake gun. And Vince urinating his pants. This was just an ability to get all like their classic hits on the show. Mm-hmm. This really felt like we want to be in a time warp at this point and go back to 98. It's what all of this felt like. And then they showed the beer bash from 1999. I thought this really dragged with these two going back and forth about this being a new era. Vince wants to be friends. And then Vince tries to leave, and it ends with Austin hitting a stunner to Vince.
Definitely dragged, but you could tell that it was almost the intent was for them to keep these two, in particular Steve Austin, on their TV for as long as possible.
Oh, yeah. And that was going to be – this was only the beginning of this segment because then we got the next chapter. Because as Vince is laid out from the stunner, out comes Shane. And Shane gets stunned. And then Stephanie comes out. And she starts yelling at Austin that this is their show. And Austin begins flirting with Stephanie and asks if she wants to give him a kiss. But instead, Stephanie slaps him. And Austin proceeds to stun Stephanie. And Austin...
The slap was basically to justify the attack on the woman.
Yeah, yeah, you can't just stun a woman without provocation.
No.
But I guess the message is...
if a woman slaps you, you could stone cold stun her.
I guess in 2005 we had a different dialogue on male-female violence on Raw.
They definitely won't do this today.
No, this felt very out of place if you're watching from today's perspective.
Yeah.
I'll say even a few weeks ago at the Ring of Honor pay-per-view, there's a spot where Maria Kanellis gets onto the apron. And she's just like, you know, she's screwing around with the baby faces. And Christopher Daniels, who's the baby face here, just walks over to Maria and punches her in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt so out of place.
Yeah.
Like what the reaction you want, you would have got, I think, years ago. Today, I don't think you're getting that reaction. It felt like it was a very awkward insert into this match, and it was just like a record scratch.
Right. It's not so much the ECW crowd where that stuff was, you know, received the big reaction. And, you know, it's not even to say, honestly, this is not bad at all. It's pro wrestling. You know, these are fake punches. It's a fake Stone Cold Stunner.
Yeah.
I'm just commenting on how they probably won't do this.
No. So then we've got Vince, Shane, and Stephanie all laid out in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And then the classic WrestleMania music plays.
Mm-hmm.
And a mannequin came to life and walked down the entranceway. Linda McMahon on Raw.
Linda was definitely the surprise because she's not the performer. She's somebody who doesn't appear as often as the other three. You feel like the segment definitely ended with the Stephanie segment. But then this cheesy WrestleMania 1990
future senator candidate.
She comes out, and you're thinking, okay.
How did this not get tons of play during her and maybe it did in Connecticut. Like,
oh,
during her
opposition?
Like, just, this is so easy to just show here's this woman drinking beer and getting laid out.
Anyway, so, you know, you're thinking, oh, okay, well, they went as far as to have Stone Cold attack Stephanie. They won't attack Linda, would they? And so that kind of creates some interest as you're watching this whole segment.
Steve, my husband, my daughter. So Austin proposes having a beer with Linda. And Linda, God bless the woman, has the charisma of like a roll of toilet paper. She says this is her family. She brings up Vince, and Austin calls him a piece of trash, and Linda concedes that point. Austin says Shane is too. But then she points at Stephanie, her lovely daughter, and Austin says Stephanie is a piece of trash too. Linda says she wants an apology. And this went on forever. Now keep in mind, Vince has been laid out for about 10 minutes at this point, just dead on the mat. Shane, not much shorter than that, and Stephanie too. They're just out cold.
Which I don't have a problem with. You know, they're supposed to be non-wrestlers, and if they take this Stone Cold Stunner,
well,
they should stay for that.
This was like comedic selling at this point. I mean, this was just a gag.
The whole segment played along like it wasn't serious, obviously.
No.
Yeah.
And then Austin apologizes, and he wants a kiss on the cheek from Linda. And then just as she is about to kiss him, he stops her and pretends he's going to make out with her, but then calls her a beer. He has a beer with Linda. He continues drinking as his music is playing, and then the music stops, and he stuns Linda. And Jim Ross says, "We will never forget this night."
Yeah.
And this was just a week or two before Linda would turn heel on poor JR.
Oh, wow. There you go. This probably was probably the reason. I don't know if it was.
This segment felt so goddamn long, but to play my own devil's advocate, this was the peak of the entire show.
Perhaps, yeah.
It was.
Oh, like in terms of ratings?
Ratings.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, and say what you will, Austin and McMahon on television together had people intrigued, even though this segment to me was just dull as hell.
Yeah, you could definitely tell they were stretching or at least really taking their time when they didn't really have the meat to drag it out that long, but you could understand why. It's just the visual of seeing these people on TV that probably was the hook. I'll say Austin, I thought, was really great here, teasing the tension. We all know that Steph's going to get stunned. We all know Linda's going to get stunned. But I thought Austin, in dragging out that tension with what seemed like a lot of improv, would be expected with him, I thought he did a pretty good job.
After the break, Vince is being helped to his limo, and Todd Grisham asks for his thoughts. And Vince says someone is going to get fired for this, which I believe is the angle that led to Jim Ross being blamed for this. I believe that's how it worked out. And Jim Ross being fired for this segment.
Yeah.
And being stunned. Then out of nowhere, we've got a Money in the Bank ladder match, which was never mentioned up until this point. It's coming up next. Edge and Matt Hardy and The Loser Leaves Raw. And
this was the culmination of their feud.
Yes. There was a lot of culminations to feuds on this go-home show for a pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. So we had Edge and Matt Hardy. Edge sneak attacked Matt Hardy on the stage as Lita was distracting Matt at the beginning.
We haven't really done too many matches from this feud. Right on.
No, they had. Well, they had the SummerSlam match, which was the stoppage, and then I believe it was the Unforgiven pay per view in September, which was the cage match where Hardy did a leg drop off the top of the cage, which I think really fucked them up.
Oh.
Leg drops off cages are not a good idea. Mm-hmm.
I was like watching bits and pieces of this whole time, but what would you say? You know, how would you say the overall reception was to this feud by this point towards the end?
I think by the end, people realized that this was a feud largely to benefit Edge, maybe to a lesser degree Lita, who was kind of part of all of it. But Matt Hardy was largely here to build up Edge. Mm. And this was not going to be some breaking out program for Matt Hardy to become a top star. But that angle where he returned on Raw after he had legitimately been fired, that got so much interest at that time.
And he screams Ring of Honor.
Yes.
In Norwich, yeah.
And it was the right feud to do. People wanted this feud, and Matt pairing Hardy. Edge and Lita, because when the story broke, Edge at that point was not paired with Lita, so they put them together and then
she was paired with Kane.
Yeah, she was paired with Kane and then turned on him to join Edge. And I mean, that was the program that took Edge into becoming a main event player. So that, that to me is the legacy of that feud, was how it elevated Edge. And I mean, Matt Hardy got back into the company and would be there for years.
But it just seemed like Matt Hardy had so much babyface momentum, legit babyface momentum, from a lot of people who might have been in his position, having somebody cheated on him. And here, you know, good guy doesn't win.
No, the good guy goes to SmackDown and becomes a mid-card player.
Uh-huh.
So that's that was the moral of the story.
You lost the girl, you lost everything.
So they had a pretty good match. I can imagine that these guys wanted to come up with as many creative spots as they could that had the least amount of risk attached to it. I mean, I cannot even, until this match occurred, this is a ladder match that I have no recollection of ever happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the problem with ladder matches when they're not done for a specific reason or have any significance.
Or promoted.
Yeah, it was just it was just a hot shot match to throw on television. The ladder is placed in the corner. Matt gets sent face first into it after a twist of fate is blocked. They fought on the ladder. Edge got tossed off onto the ladder on the top turnbuckle. And then Edge knocked the main ladder over as both go down. They go through a commercial break. Lita jumps on the back of Matt and was going for an actual rear naked choke, like trying to get the arm behind, applying it the proper way. And Matt, with some great defense, just flipped her over onto the floor. And then Matt goes to powerbomb Lita through a table when Edge stops Matt with a kendo stick and then hits a splash off the apron through the table with Matt on it. Edge is then climbing. Matt climbs up and hits a twist of fate off the ladder. Lita then uses the kendo stick to stop Matt from grabbing the briefcase, and Matt grabs the kendo stick away, knocks down Lita. He's climbing as the crowd is going nuts, and Lita pulls the ladder out from under him, and Matt is hanging on the top, and Jim Ross with the line, "Lita's taking the ladder out from under him, just like she did his life." That woman. Edge returns, knocks down Matt. He lands chest first on the top rope from being pulled down. This did not look fun.
Well, this was like an interesting little thing that they were trying. So basically, Matt is climbing the ladder. He's hanging onto the briefcase. Edge runs in, basically runs with the ladder, dragging the ladder out from underneath Matt. So Matt at this point is swinging side by side, and then Matt also, I guess, eventually lets go and gets draped along the ropes.
And in doing so, then got tied up in the ropes with his arms, and Lita crucifixed him as Edge climbed the ladder, grabbed the briefcase, and security takes Matt away.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, and that was the final note to this feud.
Yeah.
It was just, the good guy does not get his redemption.
Yeah.
He is taken away. He loses the feud. He loses the briefcase. He loses the woman. He lost everything.
Yeah.
That was the story. This was a very pro-Edge program.
It was very unsatisfying, you know, just from what little I saw of it, just knowing that this poor guy lost everything. Yes, he did get his job back, but he lost everything. And it's a little unfortunate. Now, I understand, yes, Edge probably was the one with the more upside in the main event scene, but as a story, it was just to see the villain win. He's not even necessarily a villain that you want to cheer for. You know what I mean?
There was also incredible momentum for Matt Hardy. Even at this point, him going to SmackDown, I thought would give him the ability that maybe we can get him into not a top role, but at least better than where he made out. He was always somebody that had a big following, and it was just, I mean, you could look at it as a Dolph Ziggler, as a Cesaro, and he just kind of never was able to truly get to, I think, where his backing was, that this audience, they wanted to get behind this guy, and it just, they never fully pulled the trigger on him.
The match itself, I thought it was excellent, especially for a TV match, but even just as a ladder match on its own, I thought it was really good. I thought a lot of pretty creative spots and a lot of satisfying, landings and stunts and things that were, I thought, pretty well executed. In particular, I loved the finish. I loved it with Matt draped, crucifixed on the rope, and Lita actually crucifixing him with her legs and her arms. I thought visually and symbolically it worked really well to have Lita force this guy staying stuck there while he watches Edge, the guy who took his woman away, go up and grab that briefcase. I thought it worked out really
well. I thought they were going to do a spot where his arms are still tied and then they just make out in front of him.
Oh,
like just that the full destruction of
top,
Matt Hardy.
On top of the ladder.
Oh, man.
That would have been great.
So Matt is taken away and sent to prison / SmackDown. Trish is with Ashley Massaro. Remember her? The winner of the Diva Search in 2005. And she is working on tying up Trish's bra. And then Trish checks Ashley's bra. And then Mae Young walks in with her shirt open. And then leaves the two women and goes out into the hallway where she runs into Ted DiBiase, Jim Duggan, and Superfly Jimmy Snuka and flashes them. DiBiase offers Mae money to put her shirt back on. Moolah tries to stop Mae from creating a scene, but then Jimmy Snuka is enticed by Sister Mae and goes off to find Mae Young. And that was the end of Sister Mae for the show.
Yes.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
Maria is the backstage interviewer dressed in her homecoming queen outfit. This was when she played the ditzy reporter role.
She thought this was a prom.
It was an actual, homecoming dance. Ric Flair is with her, puts over Triple H's return. He's been gone since June and is making his big return tonight. And is going to be
Triple H's.
Yes, Triple H. They're going to be teaming together and says how he returned to the WWE 4 years ago a broken man.
Let me just say to you, baby, that later on tonight we will talk about our homecoming. But right now, it's about the return of the game. And let me be very honest telling you that Ric Flair would not be standing here tonight. But we're not for Triple H. I came back to the WWE 4 years ago a broken man. That's right. I'm saying it. My spirit broken. My heart broken. My career broken. But today, I walked that aisle right here, woo, in Dallas, Texas, the Intercontinental Champion. That makes me right back where I was, a player, a man, an individual with a drive. And tonight, I walked in this ring, Carlitos Colon, and Masters, be honored. You should remember this day the rest of your life. You're climbing into the ring with the Nature Boy Ric Flair, Triple H, the game, the greatest wrestler alive today. The game and the Nature Boy, side by side. Woo! Dallas, Texas, here we come.
His spirits were in the dumps, but today he is the Intercontinental Champion. He has his drive again. And you know what? This was not only a great promo, but it had the handicap of Ric Flair looking into the camera, which it was amazing you could cut a good promo looking into the camera rather than off into Space Mountain. But Ric Flair did it. This was the best promo on the show, maybe.
It was pretty good. A lot of intensity, yes.
Compare this Ric Flair to the Ric Flair we get introducing Charlotte most weeks.
I thought Flair
other
was
than
fine
the title ceremony deal after the last pay-per-view. I mean, Rick just feels like he's so controlled now. It just feels like he's just there, and this was Ric Flair being allowed to cut a 2-minute Ric Flair promo.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it helps when you actually have a match that you're trying to promote and trying to look forward to, rather than just being sort of the manager on the sidelines.
Well, we had Ric Flair and Triple H teaming up to take on Carlito and Chris Masters, two WWE projects in 2005 that I think we can ultimately say did not reach their fruition. That'd be a good assessment of Chris Masters and Carlito.
Sure.
The Masters push, it was in full effect. Flair made his entrance, and as Flair's coming out, they just cut to Kevin Von Erich with the most disgusted look on his face. And they cut away. They immediately clear the ring. Hunter comes out. You know, Hunter's return, I can't say I really recalled this return. I think everyone remembers the return from the quad tear.
Yep.
And you were never going to top that particular return.
Nope.
But I think they somewhat tried here. It did get a big reaction in Dallas, and it had been, you know, 3 or 4 months since he had been on TV, so there was time.
Yeah, I feel like you can only do big returns
Like,
I think you get one, at most two in your whole career.
Well, yeah, but then again, you have people like The Rock or like, you know, even a Hulk Hogan who can return multiple times and a big deal is made out of it. But in terms of this Triple H return, like, it wasn't even promoted as a main event. You know, it was just another segment.
Yeah, I mean, another example of something that I think you could really argue that, hey, we're here at USA for a minimum of 5 years. We could stagger some stuff out. There's nothing that means we have to do everything this week, and our follow-up is a Linda McMahon heel turn on Jim Ross.
A lot of things probably got lost on the show. Yeah.
Like Foley coming back. Hogan did not need to be on this specific show.
Yeah.
Hunter and Flair, they did want to kick off a feud that was going to build to their next pay-per-view at the end of the month. I can see that. That did make sense to be done earlier than later. Anyway, they clear the ring of Masters and Carlito. They're delivering chops together. Hunter and Rick are doing the strut together. Carlito then gets the advantage, gets the apple, and spits it in the face of Flair. He applies the figure four, and Ross explains not only Ric Flair needing to turn over onto his abdomen, but what it does. It turns it into a modified Indian deathlock on Carlito and explains what turning the figure four over actually does.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of this guy. Can't have this bullshit explanation of submission holds. Hunter breaks up the submission.
Well, why don't you think in Japan they ever adopted that?
The figure four reversal?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's never been done.
It's just like in every Japanese match I see, the guys just don't really recognize that. They just continue rolling till they get to the ropes. They don't really, you know, use it as that, like a move that's supposed to hurt as much as the figure four itself.
I don't know what maybe the thinking is. It's certainly not a popular spot, but I don't think it gets overdone in North America either. I mean, it was always an easy Flair spot because so few people use the figure four, especially now. Ross then brings up the 1975 plane crash involving Flair, which was October the 4th of 1975. So this would have taken place the day before the 30th anniversary of that plane crash. So they're bringing that fact up. Flair fights off Carlito, goes for the tag, but before he can tag Hunter, he flops in front of Hunter. And Masters then pulls Flair away. They're beating down on him. Finally, Flair hits a low blow behind the ref's back, and Hunter gets the hot tag. He beats up on Carlito and Masters and then grabs the sledgehammer, but Carlito attacks him from behind. Hunter makes his own comeback, hits a pedigree to Carlito, and then as Masters is going to stop the pedigree, Flair clips the knee of Masters. Hunter pins Carlito, and then Hunter and Flair hug after the match. They continue to hug. They're just the best of friends. And then Ross is just selling this huge as Hunter attacks Flair with the sledgehammer. And this is the most shocking moment in the history of Jim Ross's career. What he is seeing here.
Certainly not the last time we'll see these two guys together.
Oh, my God! My God! What the fuck? My God! Somebody just hit Flair in the face with a sledgehammer.
What is that about?
My God, what? Why?
What was that for?
What the... My God! The sledgehammer to the face!
For what?
God, oh my God! Oh, Flair has been busted wide open at the hands of that sledgehammer and his best friend!
And they cut to this one girl who's got her hand covering her mouth in stunned silence as Flair is bleeding. He gets laid out right in front of Harley Race in the front row. And we go to a commercial break. And then we come back, and this went from an intense beatdown into the Peter Griffin chicken fight on Family Guy. This never ended, and it was so comedically one-sided. Like, Flair didn't so much as, like, get his hand on Hunter's chest to just try and stop him. It was Hunter, attack, attack, and Flair was, like, crying, selling. And they cut to the backstage area, and it's still going on. And Hunter fights off security. And then the locker room is watching this, and Hunter challenges everyone in the locker room to stop him, and no one will. And then he starts slapping Flair. Then he throws him into a limo. Then he breaks the window with the sledgehammer. So there's broken glass all over Flair, supposedly. And the limo drives off to God knows where. maybe into the same desert where the Filthy Animals buried him in 1999. Holy shit. Like, for Flair's own well-being, I don't want to see this feud continue. I was like, this is not a feud that needs a match attached to it. This is one superior force that has destroyed this old man.
I thought it definitely went a little too long, this beatdown. It didn't help that we didn't necessarily know the reason. I know that they were going to explain that later, but...
Hunter was saying throughout, you think I was going to let this go. And so you do at least have some reason to hear his explanation.
What reason was that? What was the...
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, you know, I mean, it was a surprising turn, you know, you didn't expect. I felt it was a little awkward seeing all those legends just ringside not reacting at all. Like, to see Harley Race just kind of sit there and like, oh, okay, that's interesting. He's going to...
Baby, it's only Wick.
Yeah.
Just say steated.
I mean, I think for added realism...
Even Coco.
They could have at least shown some concern. Could have been like Hunter just, you know...
Well, that was the idea. It's like Hunter, it's like... Even in numbers, it's like, we're not taking on Hunter.
Yeah.
And it was, to me, it was always a flaw with Hunter, which is why his babyface runs to me were always not what they could have been, because the guy, you couldn't be sympathetic towards him. You were never in doubt that this man was above everyone, that he was just, he would never put himself in very vulnerable spots, and he was positioned as above everybody, as a heel, as a babyface. It's like, this man can conquer the world, and that was largely his character.
And I think the problem is he didn't necessarily carry the aura of somebody who deserved that. You know what I mean? Like a Brock Lesnar. Like, if a Brock Lesnar is given that role, I think he's perfectly
unbelievable. Lesnar sells like huge for his opponents.
There's also great intensity in you know, all of his movements, all of his matches, but this incarnation of Triple H didn't necessarily feel that way. It felt like a guy who was basically forcing you to think that he was that, but didn't necessarily back it up.
Yeah, I feel, especially 2003 to, you know, 2006 Hunter, very good performer. Mm-hmm. The character, though, it was just, to me, it was very tough. People complain about Cena on top. Listen, those 3 years of Hunter on top, to me, were much more destructive to overall business than you could. John Cena, I feel, look at that guy. And what kind of guys he'll put over and
he's being told,
matches he has.
He's being told not to sell that much.
And I just think it's a completely different presentation of a top guy. And Hunter, to me, was... somebody that, especially at this time, I mean, he was out of the title picture, but at the same time, I mean, here was a feud that starts off with, I just feel it was so, I don't know, this was just so heavy, this angle, that it was hard to, I think for this to work, you almost have to give Flair, you have to present him as being able to compete with Hunter, and instead it was...
A man beating up a senior citizen.
Yeah, that's what this felt like. Like, it felt just... uncomfortably bad by the end. I mean, it wasn't the kind where it's like, I want to see Flair get his revenge. I want to see Flair alive. So, no idea where Flair ended up in this limo, but it just took off. And then we had all the legends are in the ring with Dusty holding the microphone, and he goes through all the various legends in the ring that we had gone over earlier.
Again, it feels very, really awkward to have all these guys just see their friend, supposed friend, get beat up for 20 minutes, and you know,
they're moving on.
That's in the past.
They're moving on. Yeah. And Greg Valentine was there in the ring as well. He was not given the microphone. And then they're interrupted by Rob Conway, who I guess the best comparison is he was in the Heath Slater role 10 years ago. He was the goof. And he makes a bunch of nursing home jokes. Absolute silence for a joke about them changing their Depends and asking what that smell is. This segment, pardon the pun, it reeked of Vince McMahon dialogue for these older guys. And tells them, this was him, and I quote, "It's time for you guys to go back to your old hoax home." The old Hulk's home. And Dusty just cut a Dusty promo on Rob Conway. And my God, the generational gap between promos was so evident here as he just admonished Rob Conway. How dare you crack whip with these legends? Crack whip.
and explained how the table that you eat off of was built by these legends.
Yeah, great line.
Great. It was tremendous. And then it set up for Harley to hit a huge punch to Rob Conway. Patterson followed. Then Duggan nailed him. We got a bionic elbow. And then, in a very smart idea, they very well could have said, how many people know Kevin Von Erich? They customized this for the people in the arena, and Kevin Von Erich applied the claw. Mm-hmm. And way, I think this was the biggest pop of the night.
Yeah.
And look at the amount of people on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I seriously think this claw was the biggest reaction of the night. They went nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely nuts for this. And then Snuka delivered a top rope splash, which I guess they wanted to be the final spot. I would have just ended it with the claw.
For a national audience, I think the splash probably was spectacular visually,
but
too.
Man, that reaction for Kevin Von Erich was just incredible.
And gave him a reason to play that theme song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Superfly.
And this was right after the Von Erichs. Kevin had sold the World Class Library over to the WWF, so there was now a relationship and a reason to put Kevin on, and then they put the documentary out the following year.
Yeah, this is a good little nostalgic segment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Dusty and Kevin Von Erich, for me, were the key points of this segment. It was really good. And then we had a three-on-two bra and panties match.
Mm-hmm.
A handicap match with Trish Stratus, who was the women's champion, and Ashley Massaro against Victoria, Tori Wilson, and Candice Michelle. And Jim Ross tells us that the USA Network has allotted us more time. The show will be longer.
Great.
Thank God.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God. Trish gets knocked to the floor. This is yet another example where I'm taking notes and just shaking my head as I feel like an idiot as I'm recapping these women in various states of undress. Ashley lost her top first. Then Victoria lost her shirt. Trish and Ashley then took down Candice and Tori. Trish went for a Hurricane Rana on the turnbuckle to Victoria, who blocked it, allowing Victoria to pull Trish's pants up, but coming off.
Yeah.
And then Victoria got sent off the turnbuckle with the Hurricane Rana, and Victoria is stripped, but you have to strip all the women. Ashley went to take off Candace's pants or underwear.
Was this Candace?
Candace was the dark-haired one.
Oh, right. Okay, yes. I thought it was Dawn Marie.
Ashley nearly pantsed her completely.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess USA was about to really set some new levels, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's ever been a cooch on Raw.
I don't think so either. That might have been a first.
And then they stripped Tori. This went 3:39 for those keeping tabs.
Yeah.
I know this was only 10 years ago. This felt like the most outdated gimmick match.
Yeah, man.
Today, especially.
Even in 2005, it really reeked of desperation.
This was not novel in 2005.
Yeah.
This was not something that grabbed ratings in 2005. It was very much something that clicked in 98, 99 with the emergence of Sable. And by 2001, like the stripper stuff, it was just...
Yeah, you're talking about the U-porn era. You're talking about the Brazzers era. You know, like this, none of this stuff is shocking to us anymore.
It was just... it felt very outdated. And especially if we look ahead to the TakeOver main event tonight, it's completely different. Such a different world. And I think for the better today.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. You know, but I gotta say, there are some creative spots in here to get these girls into position to rip their pants.
The Hurricane Rana?
That was kind of neat. They you could definitely tell, like, perhaps it was somebody like Fit Finley who really had a hand in this handicap match, planning a lot of these spots. Like, and that's a very interesting visual on its own.
Can you just imagine a round table where Fit is like trying to pick the brain of like Arn Anderson and Dean Malenko, and they're all dusty, and they're all like just sitting back and let's map this out.
Now, is this lace underwear or is this is the clip on the front or on the back of the bra?
Baby, we want your pants to exhibit some fornicating thoughts. If you will.
That's all I've got.
Very nice.
No. Bischoff is getting ready in his office for his match. And Kurt Angle walks in with just a smile on his face. Like, there's no kind of ill effects of this Iron Man match he has just gone through earlier in the night. He is all ready to go if need be. And Kurt is concerned because he saw Mr. Kennedy backstage. And Mr. Kennedy is a SmackDown guy. And Eric says he is not concerned. He says Vince has left. So he is now making this a no DQ match that he is going to have with John Cena. And he wants Kurt to be in his corner and gives the impression that if Eric wins the title tonight, he will hand it over to Kurt Angle. As we tease this title change. Michael Cole and Taz are with us after the break, and we're going to get the SmackDown portion of Raw. Because we've got No Mercy coming up this Sunday on pay-per-view, and we've got a six-man teaser with Batista, Rey Mysterio, and Chris Benoit taking on Eddie Guerrero, JBL, and Christian. And Teddy Long...
This is supposed to be ready... this was Rey's first appearance on Raw, they said.
Oh, that's right. He would have been. Yeah, this would have been...
What an appearance.
What a debut on the live show. This was a great introduction of Rey. Teddy's dancing in the ring and then joins the commentary team. All six of these guys got their entrances. Each one of them. Mm-hmm. Batista was the world champion at this point on SmackDown. Benoit was the United States champion. So they all come out, and then the match begins, and immediately Bischoff comes out and says that Vince wanted SmackDown representation, but he's gone, and he doesn't want the Raw audience to suffer through a lackluster, second-rate performance from you Friday night pieces of shit. And he turns out the lights on them and laughs and sends it to break. Mm. Now, this was not the final visual you would have, I guess, of the SmackDown folks, but goddamn, I don't think you could come up with a better way to just... if you had one of the Stridex airplanes in the arena that we used to talk about that flew right over the ring and dropped fecal matter over all six, I think it would have been less harmful.
Or if you had Frankie do that.
Frankie taking a shit on these six.
Yeah.
So these six you can pay to watch on Sunday on pay-per-view.
It definitely,
the second-rate squad.
It made all of them look like chumps, unfortunately.
Including the heels, which I always feel is... That should be a rule. Heels should not diminish other heels.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't great for two of your champions either, like the baby faces, but it was just... Everyone was grouped in as just these shitheads on the other show, which is a perception that SmackDown always had to fight, and now you're just playing to that on your own show.
And I think it would have been another thing if these guys kind of got their revenge, but they didn't really.
They really didn't on this show, and this was a big audience, many of whom probably did not watch SmackDown on the regular, and certainly was an endorsement for a pay-per-view, much less this other show that the WWE puts on every week. So we come back, Gene Okerlund is in the ring and introduces Hulk Hogan. He's back. Mm-hmm. Time heals all wounds. Unfortunately, this was a decade ago. And Gene says, I think we can all say it's been a sizzling summer, identifying immediately that this was 2005 and not 2015, and puts over his classic match with Shawn Michaels and then asks, what's next? I think he's an MMA fighter. And Hogan says that him and Sean, we can always do it one more time. Yeah. And he goes over his classic WrestleMania matches. The big ones you always think of. Andre the Giant, The Rock, and Vince McMahon, of course. Those are the three big ones, right, Way? Mm-hmm. And he says he heard a rumbling out here in the ring earlier in the night. So Hogan, not watching the show, had to go see what all this commotion was about, and he looked through, and he saw one man out here. He saw Steve Austin and asked, what would it be like if they ever faced off? And this crowd got so excited at the tease. Hulk Hogan and Steve Austin. And Hogan just threw out the question, his music played, and that was it. And then this paid off with a massive WrestleMania the following year, where they shattered all records, and this was the seed planted that harvested that next year at WrestleMania 22. Mm-hmm. A memorable WrestleMania match. Right up there with Vince.
What happened here? What was this?
This, according to Austin, he was never told that this was... They were trying to grandstand, essentially. Jeez. This was not... From my understanding, it was Hogan playing this out, and it was somewhat up in the air of how on the same page the WWE was, but, I mean, they're not sending Hogan out unscripted, you know what I mean? They're not putting him on a live show and just, go out there and have fun.
Hogan doesn't seem like the type to just go out there and just say whatever, either.
It wouldn't have... had this been a 10-minute promo, and he snuck that in, I could very well see everyone being blindsided. The fact that this was all that was mentioned... Mm-hmm. Tells me that they were just essentially trying to put Austin into a corner. And Austin doesn't do well in that position. And as you can see, this guy's mentally done with pro wrestling. Mm-hmm. I think he loves watching it. I think he loves following it. I don't think he has any desire to return. And here we are still talking about this in 2015. And if there was a time for him to come back over the last 10 years, a match with Hogan was probably it around this time period when Hogan could still get a match at that point in time. But obviously never happened, and this went nowhere.
Yeah, this was weird.
In fact, this was the last time Hogan was on television until, I think, the following summer when he would do the Orton program. So that was his next match. Eric Bischoff and Kurt Angle come out for the main event, and then John Cena comes out to a big babyface reaction. And the boos had started by this point, but this was a very pro-Cena crowd with his chain gang baseball jersey that he came out with, the
spinner belt.
The spinner belt, and just loaded with merch from head to toe. Cena and Bischoff, it was a no DQ match. It didn't go very long. Lawler said that Bischoff is not only well-versed in karate, but also jiu-jitsu. And Cena, Ross notes, is a street fighter himself. So we have two men from the streets going at it here in our main event. Fuck you, UFC. And Angle grabs Cena's foot. Cena knocks him into the post, and this allows Bischoff to attack him from behind. Cena drops him with a body slam and hits the five-knuckle shuffle. Angle comes in. An Angle slam is blocked. He goes for the FU, but Bischoff hits a low blow, and then Angle misses. It's the trademark Kurt spot where he misses with the chair, and it bounces off the top rope and ricochets into his head.
Boy, and does he do that like with full-on intensity, too. Like, he does not go light on that.
And of all, like... That is a comedy spot, and you're trying to do it as hard as possible to make it more serious, but it's at its base, it's a goofball spot.
Yeah. Well, it's not like it was that hard, but like he definitely, it's a Kurt Angle version of it, which probably for the average person is really hard.
Angle takes himself out, and Cena just hits the FU and pins Bischoff. This went under 3 minutes, and then Teddy Long comes out. He says, you embarrassed us, and he takes it to mean that Bischoff wants to do it gangsta style, and sends out the SmackDown gangsters, and attacks Cena and Angle. Batista goes for a Batista bomb to Bischoff, but he escapes as the Raw guys run in, and they go off with the air with a Raw SmackDown brawl, which would eventually set up... the Survivor Series that year. They do Raw against SmackDown. I know that the SmackDown guys got to at least have a final run-in after that awful segment, but I really thought that the SmackDown guys, other than Orton, were just such jokes on
the
show.
The fact that you end up pairing all of them together as one entity, I think already kind of diminishes any...
They're united as they're all in individual matches.
You had JBL basically set up Batista here, cheering Batista on to deliver that Batista bomb at the end.
Their big title feud over the summer was JBL and Batista.
So it just kind of made them all feel pretty insignificant. I'll say, the main event itself was pretty lackluster. I think if it was up to me, you would have either ended with the Edge Matt Hardy ladder match or the Iron Man match. I think you could have justified putting on at the end there. But overall, in terms of a 3-hour show, I thought this was a good TV special loaded with a lot of
Did this flow a lot better for you than
the
I mean, this was
Raw?
an
abnormal Raw. I mean, this was not going to be every week of Raw. And they were also going back to 2 hours the next week, which was a much easier transition.
This flowed better than most pay-per-views simply because of the star power involved and because of the special, you know, qualities of each individual segment. So I thought it was a fun show, a show that was definitely worthy of 3 hours, unlike what we get on a weekly basis.
I feel twice a year they're able to do these Raws where there's so much big stuff that it's like it's one thing after the other. Yep. You know, night after Mania.
They put a lot more money into this show.
Oh, if they
on the flights and hotel alone, I'm sure.
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, Frankie probably had his own suite. And you look at things, and UFC, they did not put on a blockbuster show.
What was the card? Do you remember?
It was David Loiseau and Evan Tanner in the main event.
Wow.
And Loiseau won that fight. That's what got him the title fight with Rich Franklin. Mm. And that show, it did 1.9 million viewers, which was very good going up against a really loaded Raw. But you look at the two, it's like the UFC didn't give away a pay-per-view main event just to say for one night we had the higher audience. But you can look at Raw and how much did you give away in one night? Mm. And certainly some of it was to combat the UFC. The other was just, it is your first night back. But, I mean, you had tons of stuff you could have saved for pay-per-views later that year.
But we know that's almost, you know, always Vince's MO is when faced with competition, that's when they want to go all out. That's when they want to really take things seriously and, you know, maybe cash in your chips maybe a little too early. But they did that here. I don't think in hindsight it was all that awful. You know, they ended up with something memorable. We're talking about it now, 10 years later.
Well, one man that was not on this show was Mike Goldberg, and here is a quick clip of Mike Goldberg, who was on the Law just a few weeks after this particular Raw, and discussed the negotiations that did go down with the WWE and ultimately choosing to stay with the UFC in 2005.
I do have to ask you about the WWE coming to you and offering you the job as announcer on Raw and replacing Jim Ross. I have to imagine for you, Mike, that must have been a little bit of a surprise.
Well, you know what? It was more of an honor than anything else, Dan. I mean, when the situation first came up, I got called by kind of a casting department. They got a hold of my agent, and then I was told that the WWE was interested in me. And would I be interested in that? And I think, you know, as a father of two and anything, and I've been a big fan of the WWE for a long time, I think what they do as far as an entertainment entity, they do as well as anybody, if not better than anybody in the world.
Right.
And so I was very honored, and they came after me, and they were very, very complimentary of my work. And basically, they became a fan of my work because a lot of the executives, a lot of the guys in the production side at the WWE are also fans of the UFC. And
right.
So, when they came to me and offered me that opportunity, it was more an honor than a surprise. Sure, it caught me off guard. I didn't realize they were watching me and my career so closely, but it really was an honor. And then the guys I dealt with, Kevin Dunn, John Gaborik, especially over at the WWE, were first class the entire process.
Now, how tough was this for you to deal with decision-wise? Because it all happened very quickly. It all went down very fast. You would have had to make some pretty major life decisions here in a short space of time.
It was difficult. I mean, it was difficult, Dan, and I think you hit it on the head. I mean, they were major life decisions. It was getting into a different area of sports casting than I'm accustomed to and than I've been in for the last 20 years. And, you know, my FSN bosses were also being consulted to see how they would react and what jobs I could continue to do at FSN, be it hosting college football or college basketball, doing my numerous play-by-play assignments, filling in for Chris Rose on the Best Damn Sports Show, period. I mean, they had to determine what comfort level they were going to have if I became the voice of Raw in the WWE. And, of course, first and foremost was the UFC. And the first conversation I had with the people at WWE was, you know, how much does the UFC mean to you? And I said, it means everything to me. I mean, I've been with the UFC since 1997. I've been on this boat driving around the water, Dan, for a long time. We're finally docking on a beautiful island. And I didn't want to jump ship. That and the fact that I have long relationships. I mean, our producer, Bruce Connell, is someone I started doing hockey with in 1995.
Right.
So, I mean, I've known Bruce for 15 years, and I've worked extensively with him for the last 10 years. And of course, obviously, the new ownership with Lorenzo Fertitta and Frank Fertitta and Dana White, they have helped me to be the lone survivor, if you will, in the transition from the old SEG days. And
it's true.
You know, we have a lot of relationships with a lot of the fighters, a lot of the fight camps, and you know, my wife comes to every event. I mean, that's my family. And when it came down to having to leave my family, that really was the determining factor. It's just something I couldn't do.
Now, you mentioned that you were a fan of the WWE and what they did. When they approached you, would you have been up to speed? Do you get a chance to pay attention to the product or not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know what? I mean, I pride myself, just like you do, Dan. I mean, I pride myself on the fact that if the next show that you're covering is all of a sudden some type of pancrase that you didn't know anything about.
Right.
I mean, between now and your airtime, Dan, you're going to know about it.
Yeah, exactly,
I mean,
yes.
I've always been like that. I mean,
right.
I did beach volleyball this year, the AVP beach volleyball tour for FSN, and I really didn't know the personalities that deeply. I mean, I knew Misty May and Carrie Walsh because they were Olympic gold medalists. I knew the name of Karch Karayan. I knew the name of Holly McPeak. But other than that, you know, my real recollection or my real resume of understanding what it was all about wasn't that deep until
right.
the first event, because I studied my tail off. So, you know, there's no question that I would have been prepared, because, I mean, that's my moniker. That's what I pride myself on as a broadcaster. And, I mean, I've called women's soccer games. I've called high school swimming over the last 20 years. And, you know, certainly when I was given those assignments, I didn't know a whole heck of a lot about it. I didn't know a whole heck of a lot about the Ultimate Fighting Championship
right.
back in December of 1997 when I went to Japan for the first time. So I certainly would have been able to get up to speed. And there's enough people in the organization of the WWE with researchers that would have helped me get up
sure.
to speed. So
sure.
that really, Dan, was never a concern.
Let's shift gears here then and talk a little bit about pro wrestling and MMA, because there's been a real debate lately about the audience, whether there's overlap between the two. Myself, I absolutely believe that the two audiences are very similar. Other people, you know, most notably people like Dana White, they don't seem to think so. Where do you see the relationship between the two audiences?
Well, I think that when you look at the WWE, the WWE is entertainment in the form of a combat sport. And the UFC is a combat sport, which is extremely entertaining. Now, if that means that the audiences are the same, well, then that can certainly be the case. But our entertainment comes from the purity and the real action in which we have inside the octagon. The WWE is different. It's entertainment first, and athletes carry on as actors to put on great performances. So they are two very different products. I mean, our moniker at the UFC is as real as it gets, and that truly is what Ultimate Fighting and Mixed Martial Arts is all about. Now, do I think that Mike and Dan may be fans of both? Absolutely. You know, Mike and Dan may be fans of the WWE and of the UFC and of the other entities that are out there and of boxing and of the National Football League. So I'm sure there is a certain overlap, but the sports are entirely different. And I think that's the thing that Dana talks about, and that's the thing that we always talk about at the UFC. We are different. We're real. I mean, we're as real as it gets. They're pure fights. The skills are different. The outcomes are not predetermined. And we understand that as we get into the situation of a UFC. And so they are distinctly different.
Now, one of the criticisms of the reality TV show is that when they show the fights, they don't put any commentators on it. Now, you being a commentator, what's your thoughts on that? Because I have heard talk that they might consider doing that with the next season.
You know what? I think it would be pretty cool. I mean, if it were Joe and I, and I'm sure if that's what happened, and the producers feel that's the best way to do it, if Joe and I have an opportunity to call those fights, I think that'd be really cool. You know, maybe that would help to a certain degree some of the new fans, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
I can watch it and see what the guys are trying to do, but
right.
maybe it'll help the new fans understand what so-and-so or so-and-so is going towards. If Joe Stevenson was in the octagon or Melvin Gillard or what, maybe that will help out.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think the atmosphere in which the UFC Training Center created also was, again, we were inside these guys' house where we weren't supposed to be, so we had that bird's-eye view. We were inside their training where we weren't supposed to be, so we had that bird's-eye view. That's what reality TV is all about. And so the fights, again, it was almost like, I think in the first couple of seasons, it was, all right, we were watching these cage fights that led to the big fight, and we weren't supposed to be able to see them. So I think to a certain degree, hearing the natural sound, hearing the coaches, was kind of a cool way
yeah.
to experience what was going on. but I certainly, I really think you'd be in a win-win. I don't think there's a lose-lose in this situation. I think if commentators were added, it would be great. But I certainly think if they were added, and Joe and I would probably be the guys fortunate enough
sure.
to do it. If we were added, Dan, we wouldn't call that type of match in that kind of atmosphere in the same way as we would call a live event or a pay-per-view,
right.
but we would be able to give some commentary, especially Joe's expertise of what so-and-so was trying to work towards, what they were doing, who was ahead on the scorecards, etc.
Mike Goldberg, still the voice of the UFC 10 years later. I don't think we would have been saying that about him with the WWE had that happened.
Mm.
Look what happened with Joey Styles. I mean, he was brought in at the Taboo Tuesday card later that year, about a month later, and he was pretty much segued into ECW and then does nothing now.
I really wish, though, Mike Goldberg could have come in to at least call one show just so that we could have those sound bites of what it would be like. Would he still keep his Goldbergisms?
As Cena hits DFU.
It is all over.
Yeah. Superman punch? He would have been tailor-made for Roman Reigns.
Everything else is virtually identical.
Tail of the tape for all the guys. Yeah. It would have been very bizarre to hear Mike Goldberg calling WWE. And probably, seriously, would have had a new name. They wouldn't have given him Goldberg.
No, you're right.
Mike.
So, Bronze.
Braun Goldman.
Braun Goldman?
I'm saying Braun Strowman. I don't know. I don't know what his name would have been. Yeah, it would have been goofy. I guarantee it. So there you go. That was the Raw homecoming. Once again, doing 5.6 million viewers for that three-hour show. And today, three-hour Raws doing around 3.2 to 3.4 every week. So they're an abnormally high Raw, but certainly not that much high above what a typical Raw would do in 2005. So there you go. We will now head on over to your feedback from this decade-old show. And we start off with Alex from Medicine Lake. I remember this show so clearly as it was a show that the WWE stacked up with so much talent and all the focus was on this show when there was a SmackDown pay-per-view that Sunday. I always found it odd why they had the babyface Matt Hardy not end the blood feud with Edge as the conquering hero. I always thought that Shawn and Angle should have been the Observer feud of the year as it was the only feud that had classic 4.5-star matches. John, do you know who was on the creative team for both brands at this time? I don't know all the players. Certainly Michael Hayes and Brian Gewirtz were the lead guys on the Raw side. This would have been during both Court Bauer and Alex Greenfield's time on the teams as well. David Lagana would have been there at this particular time. I think Andrew Goldstein would have been there in the fall of 2005. So those are some of the names. Ted DiBiase was involved in creative at that particular time, as was Dusty Rhodes. So those were some of the names at this particular time. And what are the chances that the WWE has an Eddie Guerrero week on the WWE Network to commemorate the 10th anniversary of his passing?
His appearance on the show was pretty much a month away from his death.
You're right. Yeah, it was November of that year. So, yeah, we are coming up on 10 years. Yeah, I could definitely see them doing something.
You think so?
Some
on the network, I don't. Yeah. It's just
not something specifically on his death, but you know,
the only reason I would just even question is because they seem to want to draw attention away from all the tragedy in pro wrestling lately, in particular to their own company. But obviously, would I want to see it? I think it would be a good move to do it? Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, we go to Matt in suburban Detroit. Watch this off of the WWE Raw 20 DVD set. Oh, maybe might have been on that too. Okay. I know in wrestling the legends are supposed to be given respect, but it was overkill. It's why I was proud to be a SmackDown fan instead of watching Raw. The matches were good, but the skits were brutal. Even the stunner to Shane that John probably loved.
Just couldn't get over that stunner. It was amazing.
Okay. Between TNA and the SmackDown season premiere a couple weeks before, Raw was easily the worst of the three wrestling shows. 3 out of 10 because of the Mae Young involvement.
Robin from London writes, I can't tell you how or why, but I love this show from start to finish. Shawn Michaels' terrible hair and pained expressions were the highlight on a night where WWE Creative ran wild on the USA Network and stunned the Dallas crowd into submission. 8 out of 10, although I must confess, it's probably this high due to the fact I made the switch from watching Raw to listening to Review of Raw some time ago. A good decision. P.S. I've booked my ticket to Dallas for Review Away WrestleMania weekend. Please tell me it involves ribs.
Maybe hot dogs.
Yeah, who knows? No real confirmation on that yet, but
we'll have information in the weeks and months to come.
Yes. We go to Chris in Ottawa who says, gentlemen, you have this episode of Raw to thank for the 3-hour Raws that you both have endured every day now for several years. You must have been thrilled to relive where it all began. Great match with Shawn and Kurt, some great fucked up stunners on some McMahons, and a bunch of wacky shit made this edition of the WWE's flagship TV show a great one to revisit. Finally, Kevin Von Erich's appearances are two of my favorite moments in the history of the show. The pain that man was forced to confront and the grace with which he handled it made him one of the most remarkable people in the history of the business as far as I'm concerned. A 10 out of 10 for that man. P.S. Reviewing Vince McMahon in the USWA would be the greatest.
We go to Mike from Minneapolis. I always look at the Raw 2005 fall season as the time period that Joey Styles took over for Jim Ross and was a neutered down version of himself. It's a shame to see how in a few weeks Jim Ross would get kicked in the balls, a segment that Pollock has said in previous years, how it made him pop when he saw it on CNN. Oh, that's right. During the Linda McMahon campaign, that was one of the things they showed during election night was Linda kicking Jim Ross in the balls, which was just a surreal moment that here is a CNN panel on election night, and we're looking at Jim Ross being kicked in the balls by a candidate. Seeing Christian be another guy on the roster, I can see how him going to TNA was a lifesaver for him, although his 2009 return was him essentially returning to that spot. Yeah, this was just a month before Christian would leave. I actually agreed with Jason Agnew's idea of Eric Bischoff being SmackDown GM as he was an underrated performer on the mic. I only wish that Bischoff and Paul Heyman had a promo battle nowadays. Two questions. Do you know why in the last 2 years Bischoff has only talked about WCW and WWE but has never mentioned anything TNA? Is there a reason why? One of the reasons I assume is that there is an ongoing lawsuit right now involving Eric Bischoff and TNA, which I'm imagining Eric Bischoff is probably not, it wouldn't be wise to be talking openly about TNA when there's an ongoing lawsuit. Mm. And on the WWE side, they have no interest to talk to him about TNA, so they're not going to be asking him any questions. That is a promotion that does not exist in the WWE narrative of what they present, whether it's on the network, on television. I mean, it's not as if they present like they're in any kind of promotional battle. They don't mention TNA. It does not exist in the WWE, so they have no reason to ask him about it. But I think the lawsuit is probably a big reason why. And he says, whenever this period is discussed on Bauer and Pollock, you guys always mention that Spike threw WWE under the bus and destroyed their leverage with the USA Network. What caused that to happen, and does it make Spike or WWE look bad now with hindsight being 2020? I don't think it makes Spike look bad because they were able to move on over and make UFC their undisputed number one property, and they were not going to pay WWE what they wanted. WWE ended up not getting what they wanted and ended up taking a much worse deal than the one that Spike, they could have probably just re-signed with and extended the existing deal.
Was Spike part of the part of any talks when they're up for renegotiation with the USA?
No, I don't think so. Hmm. It seemed that they were not interested. At least what I had heard was that they really had no interest specifically with WWE at that point. Hmm. And yeah, so that's about it. I'm sure WWE, and it was not great for them. Like, they found it was a public comment by Spike that they were stepping out of negotiations at that point and kind of washing their hands of the WWE. So the fact that they didn't just tell WWE this privately to allow WWE to go shop themselves around, I mean, compare that exit as opposed to what Spike did for TNA and allowing them to stay on the network for an extended period of time so they could find a new home. Mm. It was night and day.
Finally, we go to the Skull Captain, who says, belated 6th anniversary greetings from him. This is the first time I've seen this Raw, and this show did have some fun matches with some cringeworthy stuff in between, rather like most Raw episodes now. I did find it rather interesting how so many of these legends have become persona non grata with the company in the last decade. Must be hell being an editor on the network. Other random thoughts. Austin was great when he thought Stephanie was flirting with him. How could Flair not see Triple H return on him when he had that 70s Harley Race beard? Some of the signs were quite good. For example, kill Bischoff for the Nitro fans, and Hogan knows nothing. Plus, that guy flipped Hulk off when he got in the ring. Keep up the good work, guys, and remember, John, you can try to put it off now, but you know you will have to do the Naked Women's of Wrestling League review at some point.
Well, folks, thank you for all your wonderful feedback and questions. We're going to wrap things up. Next week on this particular show, Wei has selected a documentary of sorts to review. Is that accurate?
I selected the show that I'll basically watch anyway.
That's always a good idea.
And that is the NXT 24 special that is airing.
Yes, this was mainly
that
focusing
has
on...
That aired, sorry.
Yeah, that aired on Monday night on the network. Wei would like to take a look at this. I will be watching it as well, and I will now take notes for it. And this is kind of a behind the scenes at kind of the rise of NXT and culminating with the Brooklyn show SummerSlam weekend. So a kind of look at what NXT has grown and become. So it'll be fun. I hope it's good.
Are you actually looking forward to this?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It doesn't seem like it.
Listen,
it's
Thanksgiving weekend in Canada. So I think a nice 1 hour show to review.
What's your concern that this is not long enough?
No, it's fine with me. I have no problem reviewing this way.
Okay.
I have no problem.
Well, I don't sense the excitement in your voice like you usually have.
No, I am fine to go back and review this. I look forward to chatting NXT with you. We never talk about NXT.
All right, fine.
The two of us.
All right.
Okay. So that will wrap things up. Next week we are reviewing the latest... What's the series called? 24?
I think so.
Why is it called 24?
Because it's like 24... They're following for 24 hours, I assume? Like Jack
Like 24-7 was... There was a reason for that. It's because, yeah, we're following them 24-7. This is...
It's not 24-7?
Is the idea... Like, they played
up
time.
Didn't you watch the other one?
Yeah. They've done an Usos one. They did a Booker T one.
Yeah. Let me just even make sure that's the name of the thing. Yeah, NXT TakeOver Respect. WWE 24.
Okay.
NXT TakeOver Respect.
So that's a long title. Okay, well, it's up on the network. Go watch it. Leave us your critiques, your feedback, your questions. And next week, we are going to review this particular show.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll chat with you then. And taking us out is something. So check this out. It's really cool.
My name is Jason Agnew. Across from me, John Pollock. We're filling in for Dan the Mouth of Vransky tonight. And as we like to do every week, taking off to San Jose, California to talk to the one and only Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Now, Dave, I think you probably know it, but let's say you were to watch all the wrestling on TV this week that at least came into Canada here. We were up at like 15 to 17 hours of wrestling this week in mixed martial arts.
Yeah, I think I watched a lot more than that.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm sure you probably watch a lot more than that every week, though.
I felt like I watched that just on Monday alone.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, Monday alone, I went home after Raw and ended up watching some of the UFC stuff. And it's like 6 hours on one night to watch.
Yeah, not even including all the repeats in TNA and things like that, too.
Incredible amount. But it was a big week. Let's just get overall, Dave, your impressions on the week that was.
You know, I don't think there were any surprises. I think Raw was a really good show, but at the same time, all the things that we talked about beforehand, it was overloaded, and,
yeah.
And I don't know in hindsight what they really accomplished. You know, the big show, you know, tonight was the SmackDown pay-per-view, and my God, you know, I mean, it was nothing compared to, you know, what we saw on TV for free.
It was
such a nothing show.
It was forgotten. It was really a forgotten show tonight.
Yeah, so the goal should be your TV is to make you want to buy the pay-per-view, you know, not get for free, you know, something way better than what you pay $35 for. And UFC, similarly, I don't know that the pay-per-view was that much better than the TV show.
So I completely agree with you. The thing with UFC is, you know, you're always unexpected. You never know what's going to happen in the bouts, and it was a very short card.
Yeah.
Done by 11:30.
Yeah, you just, you know, that's, you know, I mean, who... When you have that, I mean, it was, you know, one punch knockout. What are you gonna, in the main event? What are you going to do? I mean, the guy was knocked out. I mean, it wasn't like it was a bad call.
He was definitely knocked out after watching that replay.
Oh, yeah.
Dave, got to go to the big story of the week, which is JR being removed from the big chair on Raw. The rumor was, not even a rumor, WWE went after Mike Goldberg. Now, we have heard on this program, I've talked to a source, that Goldberg has turned down the offer.
Yes.
And he will be staying with UFC. Do you know of anyone else that is, they're still looking to replace Ross? Who else is in contention for that chair?
I don't know. That's a really good question. We may find out as soon as Monday. I don't know what they're going to do because they pretty much made the decision to replace Ross.
Right.
And you know, I don't know that you know, I mean, they would have just found out about Goldberg the other day. You know, they have a couple of days to find someone. But, you know, like Goldberg, you know, whoever they find, unless they just go with Coachman, which is a disaster of an idea, but I'm not so sure they won't do it.
Well, I guess it's been strategic. What's the rationale behind replacing Ross? Like, what's the backstory on this, Dave?
The backstory on it is that they believe that he's not good looking enough for television. It's really just that simple, and it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, nobody watches wrestling for the, you know, for the looks of the announcer.
Keep in mind, and on top of that, Ross is on camera on Raw for what, 2 minutes a show, if that.
And so what? How much is John Madden on Monday Night Football? And it's like, I've never heard one person say that we don't watch football because John Madden's old and not good looking.
No, and the Madden...
And Ross is a better wrestling announcer than Madden is today as a football announcer.
Agreed.
So it's like, well, you know, I mean, no, it's insane. And they've gotten people in their ears and carried away. And I think it's people who don't understand what wrestling fans want. And people who are losing touch with... I think the WWE hierarchy's lost touch anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is just another example of the fact that I think that they have this idea of a product they want to present with all good-looking people. And it's just, you know, the announcer doesn't have to be good-looking. The ring announcer doesn't have to be good-looking. You know, the timekeeper doesn't have to be good-looking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not that important. It's not, you know, I don't even think I don't think all the wrestlers have to be good looking. I mean, it's good when they are, but I think some ugly wrestlers help. You know, I mean, you know, in the history of wrestling, there have been some really not good looking guys that have drawn incredible amounts of money over the years, you know, because that's, you know, it's the contrast and it's just, or they're just damn good.
Now, Dave, with this recent youth movement they're trying to go towards on Raw, how safe is Jerry Lawler's job right now?
I can't believe it's safe at all for the same reason. You know, I actually thought that when Coachman came in that Lawler was the one who was in trouble, not
mm-hmm.
Ross. But you know, you always know Ross is in trouble because, you know, they've teased trying to get rid of him for, you know, since 1999. You know, and it's always for the same reason. And so you always know he is, but in the back of your head, you always also think that, well, you know what, every time they try, it always fails and they always come back to him. And I think that will happen again, but I'm not as sure this time only because I think I think the company is real adamant this time about it. You know, as far as before, it was just kind of like, well, we're going to do it and hope the people will take to it and the people don't take to it, so we got to go back. This one, I think that it's okay. You know, we don't care what the people want. We've made our call, and I just don't know that. I have this gut feeling that this time they may not go back, but you never know because, you know, like you know, 1999 or whatever year it was when they, you know, they decided Michael Cole was going to be the host of
mm-hmm.
Raw, and, you know, that didn't work out.
You know, no, it didn't. Now, have you heard any feedback from Ross's end on this? Yes, it would be. Would it be losing a job or would he be pushed to WWE.com is what I've heard.
He's going to be pushed to WWE.com, but what does that mean? I mean, it's you know, you go from, I mean, and that's even dumber to me because it's like, you know, Raw, you know, one of the jobs of the announcer is the ability to sell getting the wrestlers over and sell getting the pay-per-views over. And Ross is the best in the business at selling getting the pay-per-views over for sure. And for the most part, getting the wrestlers over as well. And so why put him on something that's going to have, you know, comparatively 1% or even if it's 5% of the viewership of the TV show and the people there. If you're already doing that, I think you're, you know, at that point, the people who are going to watch a website broadcast of Raw have already, I don't think that they need to be swayed to buy the pay-per-view, if you know what I'm saying.
You're absolutely right. Those are the hardcores.
Yeah, so you're talking about, that's not the people, you know, that's not the people you need to have Raw selling. So the whole idea is just completely insane.